This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Golden Girl, a novel. Written by Ellen Hildebrand. Read by Aaron Bennett. Dedication. To my children, Maxwell, Dawson, and Shelby, I will never leave you. Martha. She receives a message from the front office. A new soul is about to join them, and this soul has been assigned to Martha. Martha puts on her reading glasses and finds her clipboard. The soul is arriving from Nantucket Island. Martha is both surprised and delighted. Surprised because Nantucket Harbor is where Martha met her own fateful end 2 summers ago, and she'd thought the front office was intentionally keeping her away from coastal areas so she didn't become, as Gen Z said, triggered. And Martha is delighted because, well, who doesn't love Nantucket? Martha swoops down from the northeast so that her first glimpse of the island is the lighthouse that stands sentry at the end of the slender golden arm of Great Point. Martha spies seals frolicking just off the coast and sharks stalking them a little farther out. She continues over Pulpis Harbor, where the 12-year-old class of Nantucket Community Sailing are taking their lessons in optimists. One boat keels way over and comes dangerously close to capsizing. Martha blows a little puff of air, and the boat rights itself. Martha dips over the moors, dotted with ponds and crisscrossed with sandy roads. She sees deer hiding deep in the woods. A jeep is stuck in the soft sand by Jewel Pond. Next to the jeep, a young man lets a stream of swears fly. My, oh my, Martha thinks, while his girlfriend tries to get a cell signal. She's sorry, she says. She just really wanted the early morning light for her Instagram photos. Martha chooses the scenic coastal route along the uninterrupted stretch of the South Shore. Despite the early hour, there are plenty of people out and about. A woman of a certain age throws a tennis ball into the rolling waves for a chocolate lab of a certain age. Martha misses dogs. She's far too busy to ever make it over to the pet division. A white-haired gentleman charges into the water for his morning swim. There are a handful of fishermen out on Smith's Point, a cadre of young and very attractive surfers at Cisco, and a foursome teeing off, thwack, from the first hole at the Myokomet Golf Course. As Martha floats over Nobadir Beach, she sees the town lifeguards gathering in the parking lot. Their conditioning session starts at 7:15, and it's nearly that time now. Martha has to hurry. She has 1 more minute to appreciate the island on this clear, blue morning of Saturday, June 19th. The sun glints off the gold cupola atop the Unitarian Church. A line chef at Black Eyed Susan's runs full speed down India Street, late for his shift. Across most of the island, irrigation systems switch on, sprinkling lawns and flower boxes, but not out in Sconset, where residents like to do things the old-fashioned way. They put on gardening clogs and grab watering cans. People are pouring their first cups of coffee, reading the front page of the Nantucket Standard. The 35 women who will be getting married today open their eyes and experience varying degrees of anticipation and anxiety. Contractors pull into Marine Home Center because they have punch lists that need to be completed yesterday. The summer people are arriving. They want their homes up and running. Charter fishing boats motor out of the harbor. The first batch of sugar donuts is pulled from the oven at the Downy Flake. And oh, the scent. Martha sighs. Nantucket isn't heaven, but it is heaven on earth. However, she isn't here to sightsee. She's here to collect a soul. The pinned location on Martha's map is Kingsley Road, almost at the intersection of Matticat, but not quite. Martha arrives with a full 30 seconds to spare, giving her a chance to inhale the heady fragrance of the lilacs that are in full bloom below. There's a dark-haired woman with fantastic legs jogging down the road, singing along to her music, but the rest of Kingsley is quite sleepy. 15 seconds, 10 seconds, 5 seconds. Martha double-checks her coordinates. It says she's in the right place. In the time that Martha takes her gaze off the road, tragedy strikes. It happens quickly, the literal blink of an eye. Martha winces. What a pity. All right, Martha thinks. Time to get to work. Vivi. It's a beautiful June day, the kind that Vivi writes about. In fact, all 13 of Vivian Howe's novels, beach reads set on Nantucket, start in June. Vivi has never considered changing this habit because June on Nantucket is when things begin. The summer is a newborn. It's still innocent, pristine, a blank page. At a few minutes past 7, Vivi is ready for her run. She takes the same route she's taken ever since she moved into Money Pit 10 years ago, after her divorce, down her dirt road, Kingsley, to the Matticat Road bike path. The path goes all the way to the beach, though Vivi hasn't made it that far in years, her hips. Also, she doesn't have time. Vivi is agitated despite the sunshine, the bluebird sky, and the luscious bloom of the peonies in her cutting garden. The night before, Vivi's daughter Willa called to say that she's pregnant again. This marks Willa's 4th pregnancy since last June, which was when she and Rip got married. Oh, Willie, Vivi said. Yay, hooray, good news. How far along are you? 6 weeks, Willa said. Still very, very early, Vivi thinks. Willa basically just missed her period. You took a test? Yes, mother. More than one? 2. Willa said. The first was inconclusive. The second had 2 lines. What Vivi did not say was, don't get your hopes up. Willa had miscarried 3 times. The first pregnancy had progressed to 15 weeks. Willa started bleeding while she was giving a tour of the Hadwin House to a group of VIPs from the governor's office. She ran out on the tour and drove herself to the hospital. It was a horrible day. The most physically painful and difficult of the 3 miscarriages, though after the 3rd, Willa became convinced there was a problem. A thorough examination at the Brigham and Women's Fertility Clinic in Boston, however, showed nothing wrong. Willa was a healthy 24-year-old. She had no problem getting pregnant. If Rip even looked at her, she conceived. Privately, Vivi suspected the miscarriages had something to do with Willa's type A personality, which Vivi and her ex-husband, JP, used to call her type A plus personality, because regular A's were never good enough for Willa. If this doesn't work out, why don't you and Rip take a break? You're so young. You have years and years, decades even, to conceive. What's the rush? Predictably, Willa had become defensive. What makes you think this won't work out? Do you think I'm a failure? You succeed at everything you do, Vivi said. I just think your body might benefit from a rest. I'm pregnant, Mama, Willa said. I will give birth to a perfectly healthy baby. She sounded like she was trying to convince herself. You will give birth to a perfectly healthy baby, Willie. I can't wait to hold her. Though Vivi didn't feel quite old enough to be a grandmother. She was only 51 and in terrific shape, if she did say so herself. Her dark hair, which she wore in a pixie cut, didn't have 1 strand of gray, Vivi checked every morning. She might occasionally be mistaken for the child's mother. Well, she could hope. The conversation had ended there, but an unsettled feeling had lingered in Vivi through the night. Are children ever punished for the mistakes of their parents, she wondered? Or was that just her novelist's mind at work? Vivi had woken up at 5:30, not only because it was June and sunlight streamed in through the windows like it was high noon, but also because she heard a noise. When she crept out into the hallway, she saw her daughter Carson stumbling up the stairs, smelling distinctly of marijuana. Vivi had last seen Carson the afternoon before, dressed for work in cut-off jeans and her marigold yellow oyster catcher t-shirt, her dark hair still a little damp, neat in two French braids. Carson was the most attractive of Vivi's three children, though of course Vivi wasn't supposed to think that. Carson alone favored JP. The dark hair, the clear glass green eyes, the fine pointed nose, and teeth that came in white, straight, and even. She was a Quinborough through and through, whereas both Willa and Leo favored the house. They'd inherited Vivi's overbite and crowded lowers and spent years in braces. Carson was still in her cutoffs, but she had downgraded her t-shirt to something that looked like a silver mesh handkerchief that only just covered her breasts and left her midriff and back bare except for one slender chain. She had no shoes on. Her hair was out of its braids but held kinky waves. When she saw her mother standing at the top of the stairs, her eyebrows shot up. "Madre," she said, "what's good?" "Are you just getting home?" Vivi asked, though the answer was obvious. Carson was walking in at 5:30 in the morning when her shift had ended at 11. She was 21, fine, so she'd had a drink at work and she probably went to the chicken box to catch the band's last set, when she either went to the beach with friends or hooked up with a random stranger. "Yes, ma'am." Carson sounded sober, but that only served to make Vivi angrier. "The summer isn't going to be like this, Carson," Vivi said. "I hope you're right," Carson said. "Work was slow. My tips were trash. The guys at the box all looked like they were on the junior high fencing team."
"You can't stay out all night, then come home reeking of marijuana."
"Reeking of marijuana," Carson mimicked. Vivi searched for extra patience, which was like trying to find a lost shoe in the depths of her maternal closet. This is Carson. 10 years earlier, when Vivi learned that her husband, JP, had fallen in love with his employee, Amy, Vivi had moved out. All three kids took it hard, but especially Carson. Carson had been almost 11 years old and unusually attached to Vivi. Vivian's novel that year, Along the South Shore, had been something of a breakout book, and Vivi, wanting to escape the inevitable divorce fallout, people asking what happened, people asking was she okay, people telling her she was brave, had gone on a 29-stop book tour that kept her away for 7 weeks. She'd missed the first day of school and Carson's birthday. By the time Vivi got back, Carson had changed from the funny little spitfire of the family to a troubled child who threw tantrums, swore, picked fights with her siblings, and generally did everything in her power to get attention. Vivi blamed the transformation on JP's affair, which their therapist had insisted they not disclose to the children, and JP blamed it on what he called Vivi's abandonment. 10 years had passed. Carson was no longer a little girl, but she still had her challenging moments.
"This is my house," Vivi said. "I pay the mortgage, the taxes, the insurance, the electric bill, the heating bill, the cable bill. I do the shopping and make the meals. While you're sleeping under this roof, I don't want you out all night drinking, smoking, and having sex with complete strangers. Do you know how that looks?"
Vivi stopped just short of reminding Carson that she'd already had chlamydia once the previous summer.
"You're setting a rotten example for your brother."
"He doesn't need me to set an example," Carson said. "He has Willa. I'm the screw-up. It's my job to be a hideous disappointment."
"No one said you were a hideous disappointment, sweetheart."
"I'm 21, Carson said. "I can drink legally. I can smoke pot legally."
"Since you're so grown up," Vivi said, "you can move out on your own."
"That's the plan," Carson said. "I'm saving."
"You're not saving," Vivi wanted to say.
Carson made good tips at the oyster catcher, but she spent them.
on drinks, on weed, on clothes from Erica Wilson, Millie and Grace, the lovely. Carson had finally dropped out of UVM after struggling through 5 semesters. Her cumulative GPA was a 1.6, and although Vivi was initially aghast, an education makes you good company for yourself, she knew college wasn't for everyone. "I'm not giving you a curfew," Vivi said, "but this behavior won't be tolerated." "This behavior won't be tolerated," Carson mimicked. It was the response of a 7-year-old, and yet it brought the reaction Carson wanted. Vivi took a step toward her, arm tensed. "Are you going to spank me?" Carson asked. "Of course not," Vivi said, though she kind of wanted to. "But you have to clean up your act, babe, or I'll ask you to leave." "Fine," Carson said. "I'll go to Dad's." "I'm sure Amy would take very kindly to you coming home like this." "She's not as bad as you think," Carson said. "When you demonize her, you show how insecure you are." Vivi stared at her child, but before she could come up with a response, she smelled something. "Did you cook?" Vivi asked. Carson stepped into the bedroom and slammed the door behind her. Vivi flew down the stairs to the kitchen, which was filling with black smoke. The leftover sausage and basil pasta from last night's dinner was in Vivi's brand new all-clad 3-quart sauté pan on a lit burner. The inside of the pan was charred black. Vivi turned the burner off, grabbed a towel, carried the smoldering pan outside, and set it on the flagstone path. It was so hot, it would have scorched the deck or the lawn. Brand new pan, ruined. The sausage and basil pasta in a luscious mustard cream sauce, which Vivi had been thinking of taking over to Willa's as a peace offering, ruined. And what if Vivi hadn't gotten out of bed? What if the kitchen had caught fire? What if flames had engulfed Money Pit while Vivi and Leo were sleeping? They would all be dead. Back in the kitchen, Vivi caught sight of her bottle of Casa Dragones tequila on the side counter next to a shot glass. She felt a formidable strain of fury brewing inside her. That tequila was hers. She wouldn't even let her almost ex-boyfriend Dennis make margaritas with it. Carson had come home, put the pasta on a burner, done 2 or 3 shots of Vivi's tequila, which Carson knew was not for public consumption, and then left the pasta to burn on the stove. Vivi marched back up the stairs and pounded on Carson's locked door. "You left the pan on an open flame," Vivi said. Leo would definitely be awake now, which Vivi felt bad about because it was Saturday morning, but oh well. "What is wrong with you, Carson? Do you honestly not think about anyone but yourself? Do you not think, period?" There was no response. Vivi kicked the door. "Please go away," came the response from inside. "I'm trying to sleep." "And you drank my tequila," Vivi said, "which you know is off limits." "I didn't drink the tequila," Carson said. "I haven't had a drink since I left the chicken box, and that was hours ago." Vivi blinked. Carson sounded like she was telling the truth, and she had seemed sober. "Who drank it then?" There was a pause before Carson said, "Well, who else lives here?" "Leo?" Vivi thought. She looked at Leo's bedroom door, which was shut tight. Leo had been going to high school parties since he was a sophomore, but a run-in with Jägermeister had propelled him away from the hard stuff. He drank Bud Light and the occasional White Claw. Vivi turned back to Carson's door. "You are scrubbing that pot, young lady," she said, "or buying me a new one." After Vivi poured herself some coffee, opened all the windows, turned both sailcloth ceiling fans to high, washed the shot glass, and hid what remained of the Casa Dragones in the laundry room, her kids would never find it there, she calmed down a bit. She was the mother of 3 very young adults, and parenting very young adults required just as much patience as parenting very young children. No one ever talked about this, It felt like a dirty little secret. Vivi had always imagined that by the time her kids were 24, 21, and 18, they'd all be drinking wine together around the outdoor table by the pool, and the kids would be cooking, clearing, and giving Vivi sage investment advice. Ha. Vivi ties up her running shoes and stretches her hamstrings, using the bumper of her Jeep. Then she clicks on her iTunes on her phone and takes off. Carson makes Vivi's running playlists, which she has named 9-Pound Hammer, Strawberry Cough, and White Fire OG. It took Vivi a while to figure out that these were all strains of marijuana, probably the ones that Carson was smoking when she made the respective playlists. Today, Vivi listens to 9-Pound Hammer, Shuffle. The first song is All That and More by Rainbow Kitten Surprise. The best thing about Carson as DJ is that Vivi is exposed to music she never would have heard otherwise. Over the past few months, Vivi has become an avid fan of this song. It's both folksy and bouncy. All I ever wanted was to make you happy. Just as Vivi turns the volume up, her phone whistles with a text from Dennis, her almost ex-boyfriend, who is out deep sea fishing. The text is a picture of Dennis in his wraparound sunglasses smiling, revealing the gap between his two front teeth. He's holding up a striped bass. The caption says, "Dinner." Vivi doesn't answer. A week or so earlier, she told Dennis that she needed some space, and she asked him not to spend the night at her house anymore. Predictably, this resulted in Dennis giving Vivi even less space than usual. He texts and calls and checks in, and assumes Vivi will want to grill up the striped bass he's caught. Poor Dennis. Vivi met him 3 years ago when he came to Money Pit to give her an estimate for Central Air. Dennis owns a small HVAC company. The AC was beyond Vivi's budget, but there had been chemistry between them, and they started dating. Dennis works hard, plays hard, lives in the moment, fishing whenever he gets a chance in the summer, hunting in the fall, and he's the first person to get his scalloping license every year. He loves to drive his truck onto the beach and out into the moors. He showed Vivi hidden ponds and secret coves on the island that she'd never seen before, and she has lived on Nantucket 3 times as long as he has. JP once called Dennis simple, but Vivi thinks of him as unencumbered. It was refreshing to date a man who could be happy with a good, strong cup of coffee, an honest day's work, a swim in the ocean, a craft beer, and the sunset. He made Vivi laugh. He was her fierce champion. He was terrific in bed. And for a long while, this was all she needed or wanted. She's not sure what happened. Honestly, it was like God snapped her fingers, and all Vivi could see in Dennis was what he lacked, and everything he said and did started to chafe her. The magic is gone for Vivi, and she suspects there will be no getting it back. She's ready to be a free woman again. The lilacs along Kingsley are fragrant and full. They're peaking today, and Vivi reminds herself to come back later and cut some for her bedside table. Next month, July, will be all about hydrangeas. Is another flower even photographed on Nantucket in July? Instagram would tell you no. Vivi inhales the scent of the lilacs, and this improves her mood. When she gets home from her run, she will fix Carson some avocado toast with a slice of ripe hothouse tomato, a perfectly poached egg, and flaky sea salt on the excellent sourdough from Born and Bred. Food is Vivi's love language. Carson will know she's forgiven. This summer, Carson is working as the head bartender at the Oyster Catcher, a big old wooden shambles of a place, beat up in the best way, that sits right on Jetty's Beach. There are low-slung chairs in the sand where people can have drinks while they wait to sit at one of the brightly painted picnic tables in the spacious open-air dining area. Up a few steps is the hostess station and a small stage that fits exactly one guitar player, one amp, and one mic. Up a few more steps, there's the bar, the raw bar, the kitchen, and a retail shop that sells inflatable rafts, beach toys, t-shirts, sunscreen, and candy. Vivi went to visit Carson at the Oyster Catcher for the first time in mid-May, just after it opened for the season. There were a lot of familiar faces. Vivi and Dennis stopped to talk here and there before they took seats at the bar. Carson approached, seeming uncharacteristically shy. "Can I get you two started with something to drink?" She was already so professional and smooth. She recited the specials rapturously, like she was reading poetry. "The chef has prepared a shellfish pizza tonight, featuring..." Yes, yes, they definitely wanted the lobster and scallop pizza, and they would start with a dozen oysters, a chopped salad, and the smoked bluefish pate. Carson took their order without writing anything down. She looked adorable. The cutoffs, the t-shirt, a short black canvas apron tied around her waist that held her corkscrew and her bottle opener. Carson busied herself polishing glasses, leaving Vivi to her Sauvignon Blanc and Dennis to his Bell's Two-Hearted IPA. The guitar player started up, singing Wonderwall by Oasis. The sun was going down and it was getting chilly. Vivi considered asking Carson if she wanted her to grab her a cardigan from the car, but she knew Carson would decline and, perhaps, tell her to stop acting like a mom. It was embarrassing. Just then, Zach and Pamela Bridgman took seats at the end of the bar. Vivi waved and Dennis raised his beer in their direction, but no words were exchanged. Pamela was the much older sister of Rip Bonham, Willa's husband, so they were sort of family. Pamela worked with Rip in the family's insurance agency, and her husband Zach was an air traffic controller at Nantucket Memorial. Zach and Pamela had a son, Peter, who was in Leo's class, though the two boys weren't friends. At the beginning of their senior year, Peter and Leo had gotten into a fistfight at one of the Whaler football games. Peter had said something crass and pushed Leo. Leo pushed back. Peter swung and a brawl ensued. Vivi blamed Peter. He had always been an odd, aggressive kid, and Leo was a sweetheart, a peacemaker who got along with everyone. What had Peter said to start the fight? "Something stupid," Leo told Vivi. "He's a bully." The stench of this incident had never really gone away. Hence, conversation with the Bridgmans was a challenge. Vivi used to talk to Zach about books. They went through a simultaneous obsession with Greg Iles, then with Attica Locke. But at some point, Pamela made a snarky comment, and Vivi realized that Pamela found the book conversations tiresome. If they didn't talk about books or about the boys, there was little to say. What captured Vivi's attention was the way the Bridgman's presence seemed to fluster Carson. She tripped on the rubber mat beneath her feet, tried to right herself, and crashed into a row of glassware. "Oh, shizzle," she said, then clapped a hand over her mouth. "Hey, guys, what can I get you? To drink." "Hey," Pamela offered Carson a non-smile smile. "May we see a menu?"
"I'll have a Maker's Mark over ice, please," Zach said.
"One Maker's on the rocks," Carson said. "And what about you, Pamela?"
"Menu?"
Pamela said.
"Of course,"
Carson said. She pulled a menu out of a slot, and a couple of them fell to the floor, which she ignored.
"I didn't realize you were still working here," Pamela said. "I thought maybe you'd moved on to bigger and better things."
Vivi nearly choked on her wine. Who said things like that? Well, Pamela Bonham Bridgman did. Carson withdrew a couple of inches.
"I used to be a barback. Now I'm head bartender."
"Good for you," Zach said.
"I'll have a Diet Coke," Pamela said.
"Coming right up," Carson said. "Will you two be having dinner?" Pamela laughed. "I didn't come here just for a Diet Coke." Vivi wanted to pipe up and say, "Can you please be nice? We're all family here."
"Right, of course not," Carson said. "Let me get your drinks, and then I'll take your order."
Carson's hands shook as she poured the bourbon. Some spilled over the side of the glass, but she wiped the glass down with a bar towel and handed the glass to Zach, saying, "Oh, you need a menu, too." Pamela put on her reading glasses. Pamela's most distinctive feature was her hair. It was an unusual shade of dark red with an iconic stripe of white blonde in the front. She never wore makeup, and her skin still looked pretty good. It was a pathetic habit of Vivi's to evaluate the appearance of other women to see if they were faring better or worse than Vivi herself. She had thought that by 50, she would no longer care how she looked, but she'd been wrong. When did that happen? 65? 75? 85? Pamela leaned into her husband. "We'll share." Dennis, perhaps noticing the Bridgman's intimacy, bumped shoulders with Vivi and whispered, "She's doing real good." No, well, she's doing really well, Vivi thought. But she had stopped correcting Dennis's grammar long ago. It would have been a full-time job. "Yes," Vivi said, too brightly. "She is." She eased away from Dennis and admitted to herself that the relationship was on its last, very weary pair of legs. She flagged down Carson. "Excuse me, most outstanding barkeep. May I have another glass of wine?" The second time Vivi visited Carson at the Oyster Catcher was 3 days ago, right after Vivi had gotten two pieces of extraordinary news. She had received her first ever starred McQuaid review for her forthcoming novel, Golden Girl. And, as if that weren't enough, Tanya Price of Great Morning USA had liked the book so much that she wanted to interview Vivi on national television. "I need a drink," Vivi thought. She was elated that the book was getting this kind of major attention, but she was anxious as well. The book had baggage. Vivi overheard the Oyster Catcher's manager, Nikki, say there was a 2-hour wait for a table. The bar was 3 deep. Vivi hadn't a prayer of getting a seat. She hung back and watched her daughter. What a difference a few weeks had made. Carson was the leading lady in the night's production, taking drink orders, shaking up cocktails over her shoulder like she was playing a percussion instrument, setting out platters of oysters and cherry stones on crushed ice, calling back to the kitchen for extra horseradish, high-fiving her customers, ringing the bell every time someone threw a tip in the bucket on the bar. The live music hadn't yet started, but there was a 1980s playlist going. Tainted Love segued into Don't You Want Me. People called out, "Carson, over here! Carson!" Vivi eventually wiggled her way through to the bar, where she was wedged so tightly between two parties, she could practically read their minds. Then the party stuck to Vivi's backside left, and voila, a seat opened up. Once Vivi had real estate and a drink was becoming less of a faraway dream, she relaxed a bit. The McQuaid review had been glowing. Vivi had legions of loyal readers, but she'd never quite captured the interest of the serious reviewers. The McQuaid reviews of her past books had been decidedly mediocre. They had called her first novel, The Dune Daughters, 300 pages of word salad, and because Vivi wasn't used to anyone, aside from the ruthless people at the Breadloaf Conference, criticizing her writing, the review had come as an icy shock. She'd thought it was difficult enough getting a book published, but that was just the beginning. Bringing her book out into the world was like setting her heart on a platter and allowing the public to poke, prod, scrutinize, or, worst of all, ignore it. Well, Vivian Howe was word salad no more. Her first McQuaid starred review on her 13th try. And Great Morning USA! National television coverage had eluded Vivi until now. Vivi wished her mother were still alive. Her mother had adored Great Morning USA and would have invited half of Parma, Ohio over to watch. Every indicator pointed to this book being the big one. Apparently, all Vivi had to do for this unprecedented attention
was right about the one thing she'd sworn to herself she'd keep secret. Vivi snuffed this thought out just as Carson noticed her sitting at the bar and broke into a genuine smile.
Ha, Vivi thought, caught her by surprise.
Mama, Carson said, what can I get you? As Vivi jogs down Kingsley Road, she assures herself, as she does every morning, that her kids are fine. They're fine. Willa has a good job at the Nantucket Historical Association, and her husband, Rip, just inherited a summer cottage at the entrance of Smith's Point. Willa and Rip's life has become a dream. They now own a house in town and one at the beach. More important, Willa is pregnant again. Can Vivi let herself feel optimistic about this? Yes. Willa will be fine. The baby will be fine. Carson will be a huge success at the Oyster Catcher. She's on her way to becoming a Nantucket celebrity. She'll make money, garner attention, meet people, and take the next step, food and beverage director at a hotel or club. Or maybe she'll even start her own restaurant. Carson will be fine. What about Leo? He must have been the one who drank the tequila, Vivi thinks, but why? That was so unlike him. When Leo was little, he was as sweet as dessert. But with every year that passed, he grew into more of a mystery to Vivi. He got good grades and played varsity football and lacrosse. He was well-liked at school. But is he happy? Vivi can't quite say. Still waters run deep is the phrase that comes to mind when she thinks about her son. Who knows what's really going on in that mind of his, that heart? Leo's best friend is Cruz DeSantis. As far as Vivi's concerned, Cruz is family. He has his own place at the dining table. He knows where everything goes when he unloads the dishwasher. And Vivi has been listed as one of Cruz's emergency contacts since the kids were in kindergarten. All these years, Leo and Cruz have been inseparable. Frick and freaking frack, Vivi calls them. When the boys got to high school, they discovered girls. Cruz started dating Jasmine Kelly in 10th grade, and in 11th grade, Leo succumbed to the charms of Marissa Lopresti, who had been in hot pursuit of him since middle school. Marissa is a beautiful girl, but like a bird or insect with brightly colored markings, she's dangerous. Vivi once overheard Marissa ridiculing one of her classmates' social media posts. Look at Lindsay in this pic. She's such a cow. She needs to lose 100 pounds, and she should get a nose job while she's at it. And Leo, to his credit, told her to ease up or go home. Marissa has no close girlfriends other than her older sister, Alexis. And for this reason, Marissa resents Leo's friendship with Cruz. She throws a tantrum anytime Leo and Cruz have plans to hang out, go to breakfast, golf, sit in Leo's room and play Fortnite. And more than once, Marissa has invented family drama, a fight with her mother, or a health crisis, a supposed meningitis scare, to reclaim Leo's attention. It has been agonizing for Vivi to watch. Vivi can only hope that Leo will break up with Marissa before he leaves for college in Boulder. He'll find another girlfriend. Anyone would be an improvement. Leo will be fine. Another text comes into her phone. Oh, please, she thinks, not Dennis. No, the text is from Carson. Sorry about the pan, Mama. And the tequila wasn't me. I love you. The tension in Vivi's neck and jaw releases. Her kids are fine. The song changes to opening guitar chords that seize Vivi's attention. It's Stone in Love by Journey. Vivi almost trips over her own shoes. She stops and stares at her phone screen. What is this song doing on the 9-pound hammer playlist? Did Carson add it? But Carson hates classic rock. She calls it music from beyond the grave. Vivi is spooked. This song brings back such intense memories of high school that she feels if she turns her head, she'll see Brett Caspian standing in the middle of Kingsley Road. She nearly pushes the skip button.
but she does love the song, despite her complicated history with it. And it's been so long since she's heard it. When she starts running again, she sings along, "Burning Love Comes Once in a Lifetime." Her eyes are closed, and by the time she realizes something is wrong, it's too late. Vivi's neck snaps. Her heart feels like a stick of dynamite exploding. Vivi is airborne. She's flying until her head slams against the ground. Her leg. Something is wrong with her leg. A tinny, faraway voice sings, "Golden girl, I'll keep you forever." Then the music stops. The dark turns to a velvety black. The quiet becomes silence. The Chief. Nantucket Chief of Police Ed Kapanash is on his way to work when he hears the call for an ambulance over the scanner. A woman's been found unresponsive near the Matticat bike path. By the time he gets to the station, he has the lowdown. A driver turning onto Kingsley Road from the Matticat Road noticed a woman lying on the ground. The driver pulled over and called 911. The woman's body was twisted, and she was bleeding from the mouth and had a gash on her leg. The driver said he felt a faint pulse, but when the ambulance got her to Nantucket Cottage Hospital, she was pronounced dead. Ed, sitting at his desk, bows his head. It's not even the summer solstice, and they already have what sounds like a hit and run on their hands. "Are you ready for the details you don't want to hear?" Sergeant Dixon asks. Dixon always seems to be the one who delivers the bad news.
"Yes," the chief says, meaning no.
"The deceased is Vivian Howe, the writer. You know her, right?"
"Right," Ed thinks.
Andrea reads each new book of hers the day it comes out. He's learned that on the second Tuesday in July, he shouldn't say so much as a word to his wife. She reads those novels, all of which are set on Nantucket and have plots about one scandal or another, as if the poor island didn't have enough troubles without making more up, straight through the day and into the night. She hates to be interrupted. The chief and Andrea don't know the Howe woman personally, but they're all locals, so the chief knows of her. Vivian Howe used to be married to J.P. Quinborough, who owns an ice cream parlor called The Cone on Old South Wharf. The chief knows that Vivian Howe and J.P. Quinborough have three children. Their son just graduated from the high school. He played attack on the lacrosse team, and Ed used to see him written up in the newspaper. There are daughters, too. One of them has been brought into the station a couple of times for minor infractions. It's life on an island. The chief didn't know Vivian Howe, but he knows a lot about her. And she probably knew just as much, if not more, about him. Andrea said that one year, the plot of Ms. Howe's novel came perilously close to the events of the summer when Andrea's cousin Tess and her husband Greg were killed in a sailing accident. Andrea had read Ed a passage while he was falling asleep. "Do you think she heard about Tess and Greg and used it in this book?" Andrea had asked. She'd sounded excited about the prospect rather than angry.
"Who called it in?" the chief asks Dixon now.
"Cruz DeSantis," Dixon says. The chief frowns.
"How did he get involved?"
"He's friends with the son of the deceased," Dixon says. "He was on his way over to their house when he found Ms. Howe. He said at first he thought she'd twisted her ankle. He's pretty shaken up."
"Did he see anything?"
"They're bringing him in for questioning," Dixon says. "Falco was the responding. And here's where things get uncomfortable, Chief. Falco says he saw DeSantis run the stop sign at the end of Hooper Farm Road and take off down Surfside going way too fast, less than 5 minutes before the call came in. Falco said he nearly pulled DeSantis over, but he recognized the kid and decided to let him go."
"So Falco thinks DeSantis hit the woman?"
The chief has known Cruz DeSantis since he was a toddler. Cruz's father, Joe DeSantis, owns the Nickel, a sandwich shop that the chief patronizes three,
meaning 4 and sometimes 5 days a week. Cruz is going to Dartmouth in the fall on an academic scholarship. The chief stands up.
I'll talk to him.
What?
I'll do the questioning, the chief says. Let me know as soon as we hear from the ME. I assume Falco secured the scene?
Yes, Dixon says.
Forensics is on their way from the Cape. Any other witnesses? Any joggers, dog walkers, cars driving by?
A couple pulled over after DeSantis stopped, Dixon says, but they weren't there at the time of impact.
Neighbors?
Falco knocked on doors. Nobody saw anything.
Great,
the chief says, meaning not great.
I'll talk to the kid.
Cruz DeSantis is tall, lanky, and black. He wears his hair in a military-tight buzz cut. Joe, Cruz's father, flew with the 82nd Airborne in the Second Persian Gulf War. Less than a year after Joe got home from Iraq, Joe's wife was diagnosed with a rare, aggressive type of cancer, and she died shortly after, leaving Joe with a 3-year-old to raise on his own. Joe has done a fine job with the young man, an extraordinary job. Though when the chief walks into the interview room, Cruz looks nothing like his usual self. He's wearing jeans and a rumpled t-shirt that says, "Virginity Rocks." Maybe ironic, maybe not. Joe runs a pretty tight ship. Cruz's expression is 90% devastation and 10% I don't want to be here. Behind his glasses, his eyes are watering.
Chief?
Cruz says, getting to his feet. The kid looks so shook up that the chief wants to give him a hug, but instead he indicates that Cruz should sit.
Did anyone offer you something to drink? Water? Coffee?
I can't. I don't want.
Cruz collapses in the chair and clutches his head.
Vivi is dead. He
swallows.
She's dead.
Okay,
the chief says. He wonders if he made a mistake deciding to do this interview himself. He's never had a problem separating his personal and professional lives, but the chief holds Joe in very high esteem, and he has grown fond of this kid and rooted for him to succeed.
Just take a couple deep breaths. I know you're upset. A lot of people are going to be sad when this news gets out. It's my responsibility to try and figure out what happened.
The chief eases into the seat across the table from Cruz.
Let's start with what you remember about finding Ms. Howe.
Vivi, Cruz says. She's like my second mom.
Leo and I are, well, we've been best friends since preschool. And Vivi, she jokes that I'm her favorite child. I have, like, my own seat at their dinner table. And Vivi bought a Christmas stocking with my name on it that she hangs on the mantle.
Cruz chokes up.
I feel like I belong at that house. Like I'm part of the family. Not because I'm some motherless kid she feels sorry for, but because she loves me.
I'm sorry, son.
The chief picks up his pen.
You were headed to the Howe residence when you found her? At 7:15 in the morning?
Yes, sir.
Early visit for a Saturday,
the chief says. Cruz drops his head onto the table and starts crying. The chief gives him a minute, then says,
Where were you exactly when you first saw Ms. Howe?
Walk me through it. I was coming from my house, so I took that soft left onto Kingsley and I saw a person, Vivi, lying on the ground. She was almost to the bike path, but not quite. I thought she'd hurt herself, Cruz says. I knew right away it was her. She runs that road every single morning. I thought she'd sprained her ankle, so I pulled over and hopped out. And when I reached her, I saw it was bad. I called 911.
Wait, the chief says. Let's go back. You were coming from your house? You're sure about that?
Cruz nods, but he's staring at his hands. If Falco saw Cruz run a stop sign at the end of Hooper Farm Road, then Cruz is lying. Joe and Cruz live over on Delaney, just off Cliff. It's possible, he supposes, that Falco was mistaken. Or maybe Cruz was coming from some place he wasn't supposed to be. His girlfriend's house, for example. If the chief has seen it once, he's seen it 1,000 times. When you investigate one crime, you often uncover a bunch of unrelated things that people are hiding. Cruz, the chief says, and the kid looks up. Behind his glasses, his eyes are terrified. The chief reminds himself that even good kids, even great kids, make mistakes.
Did any cars pass you on Mattaquette Road before you noticed Miss Howe?
I don't think so, Cruz says. Not that I remember.
Did you pass any pedestrians on Mattaquette Road?
No.
Did anyone other than you see what happened? Were there any bikers or joggers out?
If they saw what happened, wouldn't they have stopped? Cruz says.
Did you notice anyone on the bike path, Cruz?
No, Cruz says. I didn't notice anything except Vivi lying on the ground. I called 911. I waited for the ambulance to get there. And then I ran to the house to tell Leo what happened.
But you didn't call him from the scene?
No.
You didn't call your best friend to tell him his mother was hurt?
Cruz removes his glasses and sets them down on the table. And it's only then that the chief notices one of the lenses has a crack in it. And there's the start of a bruise under Cruz's left eye.
Leo and I got into a fight last night, Cruz says. I didn't think he'd answer if I called.
A fight? The chief thinks. That could explain the glasses, the eye. Cruz racing over to the Howe residence at 7 in the morning.
Did you see anyone in front of you on Mattaquette Road? The chief asks. Maybe a car that pulled over?
No, Cruz says. The chief will need to look at the scene himself, but if he's understanding it correctly, whoever hit Vivian Howe would have been turning on to Kingsley, as Cruz would have done. There's no chance that a car driving on the Mattaquette Road would have hit someone who wasn't even on the bike path yet. But if a driver took the soft left onto Kingsley going too fast and not paying attention, he could have hit a pedestrian. Then, if he knew Kingsley was a dead end and he wanted to get away cleanly, he most likely would have backed up and continued down Mattaquette Road.
It must have been a local, the chief thinks,
and his day gets even worse.
So you called 911 and then what happened?
I waited with Vivi, Cruz says. I held her hand and tried talking to her in case she could hear me. A couple of cars stopped. One woman asked if I was the one who'd hit her.
But you weren't?
The chief asks gently. He knows that frequently in hit and runs, the person who did the hit is the one who calls it in, pretending to be a bystander. Is that what happened here? Did Cruz turn onto Kingsley too fast? Did Vivian Howe appear in his path so suddenly that he couldn't react? Was the sun in his eyes? Was he upset about the fight with the sun? Was he maybe going over to apologize? The chief had raised his own 2 kids, and then he'd raised Tess and Greg's kids, Chloe and Finn. He has experienced enough teenage drama to write a 6-season Netflix series. Any one of his kids could have taken an eye off the road to text or change the radio station and unintentionally mowed someone down.
You weren't the one who hit her? If you did, or you think you might have and not realized it, now is the time to tell me. I know you have a bright future ahead of you, and you want to preserve that.
Chief Kapanash, Cruz says, and suddenly the kid is clear-eyed and earnest. I didn't hit Vivi. I didn't see who did. I didn't see anyone until after I called 911. Vivi was on the ground when I found her. Cruz closes his eyes, and tears stream down his face. The chief sighs. He knows he shouldn't necessarily believe the kid, but he does.
We'll need to impound your Jeep until forensics can check it out, son. I'm sorry.
He stands up.
Call your dad. Have him come get you. I'm sorry this happened.
I know you lost someone important to you in a tragic way. I've been there myself.
The boy is crying so hard now it sounds like he's choking.
She was like a mother to me, he says. I was her favorite child.
Vivi. She rises, higher and higher. She supposes this is a good thing, up and not down. But she feels like she's heading to the grocery store without her wallet, which is to say, she's not prepared. She has unattended business, big and small, back on the ground, in her life. Small. Her new all-clad quart-quart sauté pan is still sitting on the walk, and she knows that Leo and Carson will never notice it. They'll step over it, and it will fill with rain and insects. Maybe one of the field mice that have been infesting Money Pit since Vivi bought it will drown in it, or an unsuspecting blue jay will dip its beak into the acrid black water, mistaking the pan for a birdbath. It will fill with snow. It will become fused with the slate of the walk before anyone thinks to pick it up, take it inside, and scour it. Willa will do it when she comes over, Vivi supposes. Or Vivi's landscaper, Anastasia, a woman whose photo is in the dictionary next to perfectionist, will handle it. Small. Vivi has an outstanding invoice to Anastasia for $2,100. That needs to be paid. Bigger. Who will pay her bills, settle her affairs, make sure the kids are provided for? She doesn't have a will. Why would she need a will? She's 51 years old and has no medical problems. Vivi's father died when Vivi was 17, in a car in the garage, and Vivi's mother died 5 years later, at the age of 46, but she was a smoker and obese. Vivi ran every day. She was trim. She hadn't taken so much as a drag off a cigarette since leaving Ohio. She was the picture of good health. Why would she need a will? She should have had a will. She should have named an executor, someone to handle things. Vivi's best friend in the life she's leaving behind, Savannah Hamilton, is coping with her two aging parents who are in an assisted living facility in Weymouth. Her mother has Alzheimer's, her father has regular dementia, and Savannah's overwhelmed. But the kids aren't quite capable yet, not even Willa, and so Savannah will have to handle it. Bigger. Vivi's novel Golden Girl is coming out on July 13th. Vivi can recite the starred McQuaid review by heart. How digs deeper than usual in this shimmering tale of one young woman's quest to escape her past. Allison Revere grows up in a Cleveland suburb yearning to become a writer. Allison's high school boyfriend, Stott McLemore, sings in a garage band and dreams of making it big. After Allison's father kills himself, the two grow even closer and talk of getting married after they graduate. Stott writes a song for Allison called Golden Girl and is courted by a major recording label. Stott heads out to California, and Allison, devastated at losing another person so close to her, is determined to get him back to Cleveland, no matter what she has to do or say. In the second half of the novel, Allison finds herself summering with her college roommate's family on Nantucket. She moves to the island year-round, meets and marries a local boy, and publishes her first novel, entitled Golden Girl. Allison's life appears to be golden until Stott McLemore reappears and forces her to reckon with the secrets of her past. Golden Girl is filled with Howe's signature summary scenes, but it's her larger message about the irrevocable decision Allison made as a troubled teenager that will stay with the reader. The question Vivi was asked most often at her events and in interviews was, "Do you base your characters on real people? Do you write about events from your own life?" Vivi often felt like her readers wanted the answer to be yes. They yearned for the fiction to be true. Vivi explained that she used details from her real life, her white pitcher with the bisque scallop shell that she bought at Weeds on Center Street appears in three of her novels. Vivi wears Jessica Hicks jewelry, and so do all of her characters. Vivi's best friend, Savannah, is known for her witticisms, and Vivi borrowed,
stole them on a regular basis. But this wasn't the same as writing about people she knew or about her own life. Until this year. The plot of Golden Girl recounts the dramatic events of Vivi's senior year in high school. But the only person who would know this was her high school boyfriend, Brett Caspian, whom Vivi has not seen or spoken to in over 30 years. Before writing Golden Girl, Vivi had scoured the internet for any sign of Brett. He wasn't on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or Snapchat or TikTok. He wasn't on LinkedIn. Vivi had checked the white pages, but there were no Caspians listed in the greater Cleveland area. A casual email sent to the only two high school friends Vivi remained in contact with, Stephanie Simon and Gina Mariani, confirmed that Brett had never been to a class reunion. Neither had Vivi because her parents were both dead and the house in Parma sold. Though Vivi wondered what had become of him, she'd reached the conclusion that Brett Caspian didn't do social media. Wherever he was, he had no idea she was a novelist and would never, ever realize that Golden Girl was about him. Them. With a few minor changes. Concerns about Brett Caspian somewhat quelled, Vivi was excited about her new book. This was Vivi's best shot at finally hitting the top spot on the New York Times bestseller list. Number one. It sparkled for Vivi like the star on top of a Christmas tree. Her last book, Main Street Gossip, debuted at number three on the hardcover list and number two on the combined list. So close. She was poised, maybe, to get to number one this time. Vivi realizes that the powers that be aren't likely to let her return to her life on Earth so that she can move the all-clad pan off the walk, pay her landscaper, or even promote her new novel. But what about her most important responsibility? Biggest, caring for her children. Leo is 18, technically an adult, but he's still a mama's boy. He loves Vivi's cooking and often wakes up asking what she's making for dinner. He let Vivi take him to Murray's to buy clothes for his senior banquet and graduation, and he trusted her opinion, which both the girls summarily ignored. The winter before, when Vivi was knocked flat with a sinus infection, Leo binged the first three seasons of The Crown with her. And hadn't that been the thing that made her feel better? Her big, strong son snuggled up at her side? Earlier this spring, when Leo said he couldn't decide between the College of Charleston and the University of Colorado, he and Vivi made a list of pros and cons that was evenly split. He asked Vivi what she thought he should do. Selfishly, Vivi wanted Charleston. There was a direct flight from Boston, and hello, it was Charleston. But her gut told her Charleston might not be that different from Nantucket, and she thought Leo would thrive someplace completely new, like a big school in the Rocky Mountains. Boulder, she said. He'd exhaled and said, "That's my choice too, but I thought you'd be sad if I was so far away." "Oh, honey," she said. "I will be sad. You're my baby. But part of being a parent is wanting what's best for you." Vivi had planned to drive Leo out to Colorado herself. It was going to be a proper road trip with carefully curated stops at diners and kitschy motels, scenic overlooks, and historical monuments. She was going to let Leo play his music no matter how badly it hurt her ears, and she was hoping that when it was just the two of them in the car with nothing but open road ahead, they could really talk. And then, once Vivi had dropped him off, with the laminated card she'd make of laundry instructions, she would climb back in her car and have a good, loud cry. Her last child, her baby boy, launched. Vivi can't miss taking Leo to college. And she has a grandchild on the way. Everyone would agree it's patently unfair for her to die without ever holding her first grandchild. Then there's Carson, who seems to need a mother now more than ever. Vivi can't leave her kids down there by themselves. They're her kids. She's their mother. Dying isn't an option. Sorry. Vivi is up in the clouds now, though she can still make out her body lying on Kingsley. There's a white Jeep next to her. It's Cruz's Jeep.
He bolts out and runs to her.
Vivi!
He whips out his phone, and she hears him saying he needs an ambulance at Kingsley and Matticat.
My mom is hurt. It looks like she was hit. She's on the ground. She needs help.
Cruz crouches beside her, his shoulders heaving. He takes her hand.
Stay with me, Vivi. You're not going anywhere. I need you. We all need you.
They all need me, she thinks. Then she thinks, he called me his mom. Vivi hears a siren in the distance. She can't look. Her poor body and poor Cruz. Vivi turns her head away and comes face to face with a middle-aged woman with sensibly cut ash-blonde hair, wearing a flowing white muumuu and a silk scarf expertly knotted around her neck.
Hello? Vivi says.
The woman standing before her appears to be flesh and blood, and she's holding a clipboard, like someone organizing a literary luncheon. Vivi feels like she's about to be given her table number. The woman is wearing reading glasses perched on the end of her nose. Whereas the scarf is elegant and looks expensive, Vivi studies the elaborate animal print in the signature shade of orange and determines it's, excuse me, an Hermes scarf. The glasses are of the drugstore variety.
Hello, Vivian, the woman says. Welcome to the beyond. I'm Martha.
Martha looks familiar. She reminds Vivi vaguely of
your first reader, Mary Beth, Martha says. Yes, she's my younger sister.
You have got to be joking. You're Mary Beth Schumacher's sister?
When Vivi's first novel, The Dune Daughters, came out, Mary Beth Schumacher bought 20 copies and gave them to all her influential friends. These friends then told their friends and neighbors and sisters-in-law and so on and so on and so on. Just like the infamous Fabergé shampoo commercial. In this way, Vivi's devoted readership was born.
I was, Martha says. She sent me all your books right up until I died 2 summers ago. I lived in Memphis, so it was nice to read about the beach.
Memphis. Vivi went there on tour, but she stayed out by the University of Memphis, and all she remembers is Central Barbecue and the gated community where she went running. She didn't make it downtown to see Beale Street or the ducks at the Peabody Hotel. She'd told herself she'd do that next time. Now there won't be a next time.
But that's not why they assigned me to you, Martha says. It's just a coincidental aside.
Assigned you to me?
I'm your person, Martha says. I'm here to help you transition.
I think there's been a mistake.
Everyone says that, Martha says.
Vivi points to the ground where her body lies. The ambulance has arrived, and Cruz is sprinting down Kingsley toward Money Pit. He's going to tell the kids. Vivi needs to do something. Can Martha help her walk this back somehow? She tries to peek at Martha's clipboard.
Is there a place on your form, a box you can check, so that they save me at the hospital?
It's too late, Martha says. You're dead.
I'm dead, Vivi says. But I didn't do anything wrong. How can I be dead?
She doesn't want to sound too indignant. If there's one thing Vivi has learned in her 51 years, it's that you should always be polite to the people who can help you, such as flight attendants and anyone who works at the DMV.
Martha, can you explain, please? Am I being punished?
Don't be silly, Martha says.
So then why?
You got hit by a car, Martha says. It was an accident. Random bad luck.
But that's not fair.
Martha purses her lips.
Are you about to tell me that life isn't fair?
Vivi asks.
Your death was particularly sudden, Martha says.
Her tone suggests there might be some wiggle room. She scans the form on her clipboard and checks a box.
And for that reason, Vivian, I'm going to grant you a 75 VW and a 3N.
Does that mean they'll save me at the hospital?
No, Martha says. The 75 VW means a 75-day viewing window. I'll let you watch what happens down on Earth between now and Labor Day. And,
Martha holds up a finger, the 3N provision gives you the use of 3 nudges.
3 nudges?
You can influence outcomes 3 times down below, Martha says, but you should be judicious.
This feels like some kind of fairy tale, Vivi says. Am I really dead?
Yes, dear. Vivi takes in the expert tying of Martha's Hermes scarf.
That looks so effortless. I would have guessed you were French.
Well, thank you. I'm not.
What did you do when you were alive?
I was a senior vice president at FedEx.
Go, Martha, Vivi says. Lady boss.
Martha says, I can't be flattered, Vivian. You will not be revived at the hospital. You're dead. I'm granting you the summer to watch over your children and 3 nudges because you met such a random and sudden end. And because I like your books. You have a lot of fans up here.
Now it sounds like Martha is the one trying to do the flattering. Who hit me? Vivi asks. It wasn't Cruz, was it?
This is too awful to even contemplate. He's such a good kid, so brilliant, going to Dartmouth on a full ride. He's good at everything, science, math, English. Instead of writing an essay for his college application, he wrote a poem called Sacrifice about his father, Joe. Vivi's feelings for Cruz DeSantis are just as tender and protective as they are for her own kids. Martha shakes her head.
That I can't tell you.
Martha can't tell her because it's not allowed or because she doesn't know. But whatever the answer, Vivi has a more pressing question.
What happens when the summer is over?
You join the choir, Martha says.
The choir?
Of angels.
But I can't sing, Vivi says.
Martha releases a belly laugh. Don't worry, she says. You'll learn. Now come along. It's time to go.
Go where?
To the green room. Please close your eyes. Vivi regards Martha with suspicion.
I'd rather not.
You're going to have to learn to trust me, Martha says. I'm your person. Vivi waits a beat. What choice does she have? She closes her eyes. When she opens them, she's in a room with one wall missing. It feels like the kind of shoebox diorama that kids make in school. Vivi blinks as she looks around. There's a lot to take in. The crown molding and all the trim in the room is painted green, and the wallpaper is printed with eye-popping green and white vertical stripes. There are layered rugs on the floor, a neutral sisal underneath, and a gorgeous silk Persian on top. A Moroccan lantern shaped like a genie's bottle hangs from the ceiling. It's polished brass and punctured with tiny holes that cast an intricate lacy pattern of light on the ceiling. This might be... No, it definitely is the coolest, most eclectic room Vivi has ever been in. There's a long green velvet chaise, 2 peach silk souffle chairs, a coffee table that looks like a giant white enamel bean, leather pouf ottomans, 2 dwarf orange trees in copper pots, and a huge black and white photograph on the wall that Vivi identifies as a David Yarrow Western scene. This is the boho chic room of my dreams,